This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
So everyone here knows that Jenny Lawson is ridiculously funny, right? Every time I put her book in customers' hands, I have to warn them that they might pee themselves laughing. I also always tell them this story for some reason. Years ago, when I read Let's Pretend This Never Happened, I was on a flight to New Mexico and laughed out loud the entire time, including during a bout of some of the most frightening, intense turbulence I have ever had the horror to experience. I wasn't trying to read. It's just that her book just was, I was in the middle of it and it fell open on the tray. And every time I glanced down at the page, I accidentally read some of the text and just kept laughing. And I was like, the whole plane was shaking and it was like really horrifying. And I thought I was going to die, but I was like, no, I'm just laughing. Just laughing. Because what is fear of turbulence anyway, but an intense anxiety that you will die and there is not a damn thing you can do about it. All you can really do in the moment is give up the illusion of control and laugh. But most of us usually have panic attacks. But this time I didn't. So thank you, Jenny, for giving me a gift in such a moment. Because Jenny Lawson has given that gift to so many of us who choose to fight against our own brains on a daily basis. She has the courage and the strength to stand up and make the choice to live an active life when mental illness wants to drag her down into its black hole, soul-sucking pit of despair. To those who have never experienced depression or severe anxiety or even lived with a loved one who does, you must read Furiously Happy. And to those who fight the war with mental illness every day, you must read Furiously Happy. It is a manifesto of profound defiance and courage, using humor and joy to get through the horror of being your own worst enemy. I could say so many more things, but I'll never say it as well as this amazing woman. So please join me in welcoming Jenny Lawson.
Shit, you guys. Do you know how many? There's a lot of people here. Oh. This was the wrong day to stop taking beta blockers. Oh. Okay, if I get through this, my therapist will be so proud of me. First off, thank you. Thank you for being here. Especially because I know a lot of you have the same sort of issues that I do, and so being here is not something that is easy. I will tell you, if you are anxiety prone, every single person in this room will understand it and will happily hand you Xanax or Klonopin or whatever your drug of choice is. So that's always the thing that always helps me to relax, is just knowing I can freak out at any time and say, hey, hon, I'll be right back, and then just hide back here, and you guys will talk amongst yourselves. And that is a wonderful thing. So thank you for that. Thank you also for the amazing support that you have given both to me, to the community as a whole, and to this strange little book. When I was writing this book, which took years, so if you're struggling with writing a book and it's taken you years, that's okay. You're on the right choice. When I was writing it, my editor was like, you know, I think, why don't we put it out in the fall? And the fall is going to be like, it's harder. You're probably not going to get on the, you know, any of the lists or, you know, get any, you know, big attention or anything. But, people have a tendency to buy books more, and this is a book that I think that people should read. And so, Let's do it then. Are you okay with it not, you know, making it on the New York Times list, not actually, you know, looking from the outside in like it's successful? And I was like, that's fine with me. I'd like for people to be able to understand what it's like in my head so they could feel less alone, or help to understand somebody that they love that maybe is going through the same thing. It came as a great surprise to me when it did make it. It's number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. And it's for the second week in a row. It is again number three, which is sort of insane because even the first book, which opened at number one on like an easier season, like dropped to number 12 the next week, which is still like amazing. But the fact that this has kind of kept its place says so much about the fact that the community itself is talking about it and so many people are sharing it and finding it for the first time. And I'm amazed at how many people come up and say, I have no idea what you're talking about, that you have a blog or you have a first book or whatever. But my daughter brought this to me because she wanted me to understand, like, this is what's going on in my head. This helped me to understand. And it wouldn't get to people if it wasn't for the amazing support that you guys have given. So thank you so much for that. I'm going to read two chapters, one that's a titch long, one that is teensy tiny. This is the scariest part of my day, and I'm going to do this, and I have toothpaste on my shirt. And you're going to find this really hard to believe, but I have not taken my ADD meds, and so that's why I'm distracted by my pajamas. By the way, these are my pajamas. Okay.
Got it, girl.
Yeah. Furiously happy, dangerously sad. You're not crazy. Stop calling yourself crazy, my mom says for the 110 billionth time. You're sensitive and a little odd. And fucked up enough to require an assload of meds, I add. That's not crazy, my mom says as she turns back to scrubbing the dishes. You're not crazy, and you need to stop saying that you are. It makes you sound like a lunatic. I laugh because this is a familiar argument. This is the same one that we have had a million times before, and it's the same one that we'll have a million times again, so I let it lie. And besides, she is technically right. I'm not technically crazy, but crazy is a much simpler way of labeling what I really am. According to the many shrinks that I've seen in the last two decades, I am a high-functioning depressive with severe anxiety disorder, moderate clinical depression, and mild self-harm issues that stem from an impulse control disorder. I have avoidance personality disorder, which is like social anxiety disorder on speed, and occasional depersonalization disorder, which makes me feel utterly detached from reality, but in less of a this LSD is awesome kind of way and more of a I wonder what my face is doing right now sort of thing, or it sure would be nice to feel emotions again kind of way. I have rheumatoid arthritis and autoimmune issues, and sprinkled in, like paprika over a mentally unbalanced deviled egg, are things like mild OCD and trichotillomania, the urge to pull one's hair out, which is always nice to end on because whenever people hear the word mania, they automatically back off and give you more room on crowded airplanes. Probably because you're not supposed to talk about having manias on crowded airplanes. This is one of the reasons why my husband Victor hates to fly with me. The other reason is I often fly with taxidermied creatures as anxiety service companions. Basically, we don't travel a lot together because he doesn't understand awesomeness. You're not a maniac, my mom says in an aggravated voice. You like to pull your hair. You even did it when you were little. It's soothing to you. It's like petting a kitten. I like to pull my hair out, I clarify. It's sort of different. That's why they call it a mania and not kitten petting disorder. Which honestly would suck because then you'd end up with a bunch of bald kittens who would hate you. My God, I hope I never get overly enthusiastic kitten fur pulling disorder. My mother sighs deeply, but this is exactly why I love having these conversations with her, because she gives me perspective. It is also why she hates having these conversations with me, because I give her details. You are perfectly normal, my mom says, shaking her head as if even her body won't let her get away with this sort of lie. I laugh as I tug involuntarily at my hair. I have never been normal, and I think we both know that. My mom pauses for a moment, trying to think up another line of defense, but it is pretty hopeless. I have always been naturally anxious to ridiculous degrees. My earliest school memory is of a field trip to a hospital when a doctor pulled out some blood samples, and I immediately passed out right into a wall of thankfully empty bedpans. According to the other kids present, the teacher said, "Ignore her, she just wants attention." True story. Then my head started bleeding, and the doctor cracked open an ammonia capsule under my nose, which is a lot like being punched in the face by an invisible fist of stink. Honestly, I didn't know why I had passed out. My baseline of anxiety remained the same, but my subconscious was apparently so terrified that it decided the safest place for me to be would be fast asleep on the floor, surrounded by bedpans. Which sort of shows why my body is an idiot. Because forced narcolepsy is pretty much the worst self-defense ever. It's like the human version of playing possum, which is only helpful if bears are trying to eat you, because, for real, apparently, if you lay down in front of bears, they're all, what a badass, I attack her and she takes a cat nap, I probably shouldn't fuck with her. This would be the start of a long and ridiculous period of my life, which Shrink's label white coat syndrome. My family refers to it as what the hell is wrong with Jenny syndrome, and I think my family was more accurate in their assessment, because passing out when you see doctor's coats is just damn ridiculous and more than slightly embarrassing, especially later when you have to say, sorry I passed out on you, apparently I'm afraid of coats. To make things even worse, when I pass out I tend to flail about on the floor and apparently I moan gutturally. Like a Frankenstein, according to my mother, who has witnessed this on several occasions. Other people might battle a subconscious fear of adversity or failure or being stoned to death, but my hidden phobia makes me faint at the sight of outerwear. I have passed out once at the optometrist, twice at the dentist office, and two horrifying times at the gynecologist's. The nice thing about passing out at the gynecologist, though, is that if you're already in the stirrups, you don't have very far to fall. Unless, of course, you're like me and you flail about wildly while you're moaning and unconscious. It's pretty much the worst way to pass out with someone inside your vagina. It's like having a really unattractive orgasm you're not even awake for. I always remind my gynecologist that I might rather loudly pass out during a pap smear, and then she grimly informs me that she didn't need me to remind her at all. The bad part about passing out of the gynecologist is you occasionally regain consciousness with an unexpected speculum inside your vagina, which is essentially the third worst way to wake up. The second worst way to wake up is at the gynecologist without a speculum inside of you, because the gynecologist took it out when you passed out and now you have to start all over again, which is why I always tell my gynecologist that if I pass out, she should just take the opportunity to get the whole thing out of the way. The first worst way to wake up, by the way, is to find bears eating you because your body thought its safe defense was to fall asleep in front of bears. That playing possum bullshit almost never works. Not that I would know, because I would never pass out in front of bears and have, in fact, been known to run at bears to get good pictures of them. Instead, I pass out in front of coats, which, according to my brain, are the things you really need to be concerned about. One time, I loudly lost consciousness at my veterinarian's office when he called my name. Apparently, my subconscious freaked out when I saw the blood on the vet's coat, and then I abruptly passed out right on my cat. That is not a euphemism. I woke up shirtless in the lobby with a bunch of strangers and dogs looking down at me. Evidently, when I started moaning, the vet called the ambulance, and then when the EMTs came, they claimed they couldn't find my heartbeat, so they ripped open my shirt. Personally, I think they just wanted a cheap thrill. I think the dogs looking down at me agreed, as they seemed slightly embarrassed for me after watching the whole episode unfold. But you can't really blame dogs, because first of all, who can look away from a train wreck like that? And secondly, dogs have no concept of modesty. Waking up shirtless with a bunch of concerned dogs staring at your bra because you're afraid of coats is about the seventh worst way to wake up. I mutter aloud to my mother. My mom says noncommittally, raising a single eyebrow. Well, okay, maybe you're not normal, she says grudgingly. But who wants to be normal? You're fine. You are perfectly fine. You are better than normal, even, because you're so aware of what's wrong with you that you can recognize it and sort of fix it. I nod. She has a point, although the rest of the world might disagree with our definition of fixing it. When I was little, I fixed it by hiding from the world in my empty toy box whenever my undiagnosed anxiety got too unbearable. In high school, I fixed it by isolating myself from other people, and in college, I fixed it with eating disorders, controlling what I ate to compensate for the lack of control that I felt with my emotions. And now, as an adult, I control it with medication and with shrink visits and with behavioral therapy. I control it by being painfully honest about just how crazy I am. I control it by allowing myself to hide in bathrooms and under tables during important events. And sometimes I control it by letting it control me, because I have no other choice. Sometimes I'm unable to get out of bed for a week at a time. Anxiety attacks are still an uncomfortable and terrifying part of my life. But after my furiously happy epiphany, I've learned the importance of pushing through, knowing that one day soon I will be happy again. This is why I sneak into other people's bathrooms in haunted hotels and once accepted a job as a political czar who reports directly to the stray cat that sleeps at City Hall. I have staged live zombie apocalypse drills in crowded ballrooms. I've landed on aircraft carriers at sea. I once crowdfunded enough money to buy a taxidermied Pegasus. I am furiously happy. It's not a cure for mental illness. It's a weapon designed to counter it. It's a way to take back some of the joy that's robbed from you when you're crazy. Ah, you're not crazy, my mom says again, waving a wet plate at me. Stop saying you're crazy. People will think you're a lunatic. And it's true. They will. I Google the word lunatic on my phone and read her one of the definitions. Lunatic, noun. Wildly or giddily foolish. My mom pauses, stares at me, and finally sighs in resignation, recognizing way too much of me in that definition. She says, shrugging thoughtfully as she turns back to the sink. So, maybe crazy isn't so bad after all. I agree. Sometimes crazy is just right. And now we'll do the super fast chapter, which is so much easier. Okay. Now that I've said that, I've jinxed myself, and I'm totally not going to say it right. All right. I have found a kindred soul, and he has a very healthy coat. A few weeks ago, I was at the pharmacy picking up my meds, and I was staring into the drive-thru window and thinking about how awesome it is that we live in a world where you can pick up drugs in a drive-thru. And that's when I noticed something strange next to the pharmacist register. I don't know if you can see a picture there, but that's an open box of Milk-Bone dog biscuits. And I thought, well, that's odd, but maybe someone returned them because they were stale or something. And I thought it was even odder that someone could realize that dog biscuits had gone stale because dogs are usually not very good at not eating cookies, even if they're fairly shitty. Dogs eat used diapers if you let them, so I'm pretty sure none of them are saying no to cookies. But then the pharmacist came back, and while he was ringing me up, he reached over and picked up a handful of broken dog biscuits and ate them. And then I thought, wait, am I high? Is he high? Am I being tested? Should I say something? But I didn't, because I'm pretty sure you're not supposed to accuse the man giving you drugs of eating dog food. And then I signed for the drugs and I drove away and I thought to myself, is it possible that he accidentally ate the dog biscuits? Or maybe someone is always stealing his food at work, so he decided to put his tasty human cookies, made for humans, not out of humans, in a Milk-Bone box to keep them safe. Or maybe he just likes to entertain himself by seeing if people will tell him that he is eating dog food. Those would be good people, probably. I'm not one of those people. But then I spent all day thinking, why the dog biscuits? And so I went back today to ask, but the dog biscuits were gone, and the dog biscuit eating guy was also gone, and I thought, can I ask this pharmacist if the other pharmacist who eats dog food is around, because I really need to know the story? And the answer is no, I can't. But I really want to know, because I suspect that I would be great friends with this guy, because anyone who would hide crackers in a dog food box seems like someone I'd want to hang out with. Although someone who just eats dog food for fun seems slightly more questionable. Except now I'm wondering if maybe Milk-Bones are delicious and he's just a genius who's discovered really cheap cookies. Cookies you don't have to call your judgmental vet about when your dog gets into the pantry and eats all of them. You still have to call the vet, though, when your cat has eaten a toy consisting of a Tinkerbell and a feather and a poof ball all tied together with twine. And that actually happened to me once, and it was really the worst because the vet told me that I would have to ply the cat with laxatives in order to make sure that the toy would pass through easily, and then I'd need to inspect the poop to make sure that it had gone all the way through. Otherwise, they would have to do open cat surgery. And then it finally did start to pass, but just the first part with the Tinkerbell. And the cat was freaked out because he was running away from the Tinkerbell, which was hanging out of his butthole. And when I called the vet, he said to definitely not pull on the twine because it would pull out his intestines, which would be the grossest pinata ever. And so I just ran after the cat with some scissors to cut off the tinkle bell, which impressively was still tinkling after seeing things that no tinkle bell should ever have to see. Probably the cat was running away both because he was afraid of the tinkle bell and because I was chasing it with large scissors yelling, "Let me help you!" If I was good friends with that dog food eating pharmacist, I would have called him to tell him about the tinkle bell issue because I think he would probably appreciate it. But I never found him again because I was worried that if I ever asked to see the dog food eating pharmacist, the other pharmacist would stop giving me drugs. This all feels a bit discriminatory, but I can't explain exactly why. We're done with the scary part! Woohoo! So now we get to do... Okay, wait. First, because I'm going to forget otherwise. First, we're going to do a picture, and then we'll do Q&A. Dun, 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 dun. What's my passcode? I don't know. I had, like, true story, Victor put on a passcode because I left my phone at a signing, and he was like, well, at least nobody could tweet stuff, and I was like, why wouldn't they? And he was like, because of your password? I'm like, who has a password? He was like, Jesus Christ, go! And so now I'm always like, what's the password? And he's like, it's 1111. Oh, now you all know it. Don't tell him. But I still, like, quite often forget it, and I'll be like, oh, no. And he's like, seriously, it's the easiest password ever. So, okay, so we're going to take a picture. I'm going to do panoramic, which is going to be crazy. Let's see. All right. Yay. And we're starting. And look, my camera's going, slow down. Shut up, camera. You're not the boss of me. Slow down. I will not slow down. This is how fast we're going. Now it's telling me to go down. That's rude. It's enough out of you, camera. All right. So, let's start the questions.
Remember to use the microphone?
Oh, yes. Yes. Question.
So in your first book, you said you were going to tell us the story of when your sister was chased by a pig on the playground.
You know,
I never forget.
I'm going to have to tell my friend Karen that you asked that question, because when I sent her like the original, and she was like, you know, you didn't tell, there's two stories in there you didn't tell, you were going to tell in the first one, and I was like, well, maybe I'll just keep saying, like, oh, that's in the next book. And she was like, yeah, you're a liar, basically is what you are. So I actually did have it in there, and then it got cut, and so it'll probably will be in the next one. But really, long story short, my sister got chased on the playground by a pig. This was after the geese. We lived out in the country, and I mean, just like super crazy rural, and our neighbors owned prize show pigs. So pretty glamorous, right? These were not just like normal pigs. They were like fancy pigs. But they would get out all the time. And when they would get out, they would like come over to our house, and then they would lay their pig babies. That's not what it's called, but like, it's like laying eggs, but live eggs. I don't know. I'm not good with science. But I'd always like find these babies, and I'd be like, oh, babies. And let me tell you, if you get close to babies while the mama pig is there, that mama pig will fucking kill you. Like, she's like, mm-mm, no, you are not cute. Get away. They're like grizzly bears. If they were wearing coats, they would be scarier. But anyway, this mama pig had babies like on our playground, because it was right next to because we lived like, here was us, there was our school, there's the pig farm, so like that was the corner of crazy is what that was. And so my sister got chased down by this because she was too close to like a litter that was like hidden underneath the slides. And this slide, they weren't even like real slides, they were, I don't know if this is like just a Texas thing, but when I was a kid, we didn't have like the real you know, like they have like the cool plasticky kind of slides, yeah. And they're not real slides, and you get on them and you get stuck because you're old. but even kids get stuck. Okay, so we, like the farmers around, they would get old sheet metal and they would make us our slides, right? And the slides would be like 3 stories tall, you know? They would just be, and they're made out of sheet metal, so they're super bumpy, and they just like, you fry all your skin off immediately because it's so hot. Just terrible. But anyway, this pig was like, this is where I should have babies. She was not a good mother. Anyway, then she chased down my sister, and I thought it was really funny. And I felt bad about it later, which is part of the reason why it's not in there yet, because I had to find a good way to put it in the book that's not just like, hey, you want to hear something terrible that happened to my sister? There has to be like an actual moral, I think. But I haven't found a moral yet. But thank you for calling me out. And
one. What are the latest antics of Whitey and Klaus Banana Snatch?
Whitey and Klaus Banana Snatch are the horrific swans who live in my neighborhood. They absolutely hate me. They don't hate anyone else. They're all like, oh, whatever. Look, we're sweet, lovely little swans. And I'm like, fuck you, Whitey. I know what you're up to. Which goes over weird in my like Republican stronghold community where I'm the only Democrat. And I'm like, well, I'm talking to you guys too. Shut up. You know, actually, one of them disappeared for a really long time. And I thought, I was like, well, probably somebody took him out. Like, probably he, like, attacked. And, so this one, like, the single swan was just, and I couldn't tell because I didn't want to get close enough to see if it was Klaus or Whitey. And so I was like, well, it's one of them. And then it showed back up, like, 2 weeks later. And all I could think was, he probably was going to bury a body, like, really far away. Because there's no, where else would he be? There's no reason. Unless you're burying a body. If I disappear for 2 weeks, it's because I'm burying a body.
Okay. Noted.
Yes. Okay. And over here. We'll go odd and even.
I want you to have your due applause, though. I have to know about the dog biscuits. Like, it's been a while. You have to go to the same pharmacy most of the time. Like, what was up with that?
Okay, so... I have not written about this yet, so you guys are going to hear about it first. But, so that guy never came back. The dog biscuits never showed up again. But I've had 3 different people, including one today. If you look at my like, favorited tweets, there's somebody who's like, that guy moved to Minnesota. Because look, here is the, you know. And but somebody actually did go up to one of the, then they were like, why do you have dog biscuits in the pharmacy? And they were like, well... sometimes we fill animal medication. And so we give out dog biscuits if somebody comes in the car with their dog. And I was like, well, that makes sense. So, like when you go to the bank and you have a kid and they give you like a lollipop. And I'm always like, I want a lollipop. You know, just stop wanting lollipops. Except that this pharmacy, they don't fill dog stuff. There's no reason. So I don't know. Maybe he was just maybe the last place had him, and he just was like, oh, they're just delicious. I thought they were here for fun. Are they not for us? I don't know. But that did at least make sense a little bit when I keep seeing people like posting pictures everywhere going, oh my God, it's spreading. What's happening?
Thank you.
Yes. Yes. In the lovely red dress.
Thank you. First, I wanted to say thank you for being so open with your life. Last summer, I had a nervous breakdown of epic proportions, and taking some wisdom from what I'd read about you, I came out to my family about my mental illness, my bipolar, and scads of everything else. I got a lot of nasty blowback from people who said that never happened or it shouldn't still bother you. Some of them have slowly come to terms. Have you experienced a lot of harsh blowback from your family for some of the things that you talked about, and how do you deal with that?
That is a really good question. This is being taped, but I'm just going to say it anyway. Two different things. So my side of the family, like my parents, there's all sorts of mental illness that runs in my family. And for all of us, it's clinical rather than, you know, caused by an actual episode. But it still was something that was never, ever talked about. When I was growing up, my father had nervous breakdowns, and I didn't know what was going on, and I just thought, something wrong is here, but I don't know what it is, and I think I may have caused it, and I'm not really sure. And it wasn't until I was grown and shared my diagnosis that I found out that I was not alone in this. And I wish that he would have felt comfortable talking to me about it, but for him, it was very much a, you don't talk about it, that's something that you keep secret, it's going to affect you, it will affect you in your job, it will affect you in everything, people will judge you. I will say that when the first book came out, I talked about, you know, my anxiety and different stuff like that, and there was some stuff that I wanted to talk about that I didn't talk about because I felt like it wasn't really my story to tell, because a lot of it was my father who suffered and my aunt, who in some ways is not here because of her issues and things like that. And in the last couple of years, in watching the reaction of what I've written, my father has completely come out to his family, to everyone that he works with. Right before, the week before I went out on tour, I did like a book trailer, but I was like, instead of a book trailer, let's just do a thing where people hold up signs and they say, this is why I'm broken, but this is why I'm furiously happy. And my dad sent me a letter and said, you know, I'm broken because I'm mentally ill, but I'm furiously happy because I have one daughter who gave me, you know, beautiful grandkids and another one who gave me a story that made me feel better about myself and let me come out. So in that way, it was incredibly wonderful and fantastic. I will say on my in-laws' side, and I have a rule that I don't write anything that might like not necessarily be a nice thing, but it's kind of different when I'm speaking about it because I think it's important to speak your truth, and nothing that I say is something that they would say, that's not real. They have some issues with it, and there has been a lot, especially with them reading some stuff that they were not completely aware of. I think it's easier now. It's not easy, but it's easier to say, I have depression, and people are like, oh, okay, I've heard of other people having depression. I understand. It's a little different when they start getting to the self-harm stuff and the trichotillomania and some of the darker stuff. And I did have some pullback and some, don't you think you're maybe going to affect your child? Do you think maybe it's not safe? And, you know, and it was, you know, in a way it was really painful because these are people I've known for 20 years and they know me and they know who I am. But at the same time, it was really a great thing because I realized that they were the people I was writing this book for. So I could hand it to them and be like, look, you're the one with the problem. You're the one who doesn't understand this. You're the one who doesn't understand that one in four people is going to be mentally ill. That in your life, you're going to deal with people you love will be, you know, dealing with this. That this does not change who you are. It's just a facet of it. And read this book, and hopefully it'll help. And I don't think that they've read it, but I think that they are slowly starting to understand. And honestly, not because of the book. They're starting to understand because they're opening up the newspaper and seeing something that says, Jenny Lawson speaking about ending the stigma of mental illness. And they're like, oh, why is she in our newspaper? Okay, maybe she does have a point, which is really awesome, I have to say. So be strong. Be strong. Be strong. Know you are not alone. And remember that all the things that you hear people say, they're always going to sound worse to you because the voices in our head are already saying all those terrible things. So remember that depression lies. And at the same time, when people don't understand, their automatic fear reaction is a scary thing. And unfortunately, teaching them is a really, really good thing. So that's sort of, and whenever I feel like it gets a little bit too hard, I think, well, what is it going to be like if, I don't think my daughter's going to have any of the same issues that I have, but she might very well have her own unique issues that I struggle to understand, that I won't understand. And so I just think, well, if that make it easier for me, it'll make it easier for her one day, or any grandkids I have, or, you know, nieces or nephews or people in the future that I love.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I love your hat.
Thanks.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, I love this hat too. I'm going to fangirl for like 20 seconds, and then I do have an actual question in the form of a question. So I saw you speak when you were in New York. I was living there when you went on your first tour. Uh-huh. And so I stole your idea of like writing stuff on my arm when I was having some feelings. Yeah. And wrote Depression Lies a lot. So thanks. I actually have my own tattoo now. It's not Depression Lies, but it's similar sentiment. But anyway, so it actually, this is a tie-in to the whole idea of like mental illness in your family and blah, blah, blah. I have a lot of stuff. ADHD is my number one friend, but also there's depression and anxiety, and my brother just got diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and there's a lot of it in my side of the family. My fiance also has a little bit of that in his side of the family, and, you know, we're talking about starting a family and all that kind of stuff. So I guess my question is a two-part question. One, how did you, or, I mean, was there a fear of, you know, passing that on to kids? How did you deal with that fear, and how do you deal with, I guess, talking to your daughter about it and saying, like, hey, this is a thing that your mom deals with every day, and, like, I'm not crazy, but, like, this is a thing, and sometimes mommy can't get out of bed, and, like, I don't know. Yeah. How do you deal with it?
That's an excellent question. I only recently started using the actual words of, like, depression, anxiety disorder, that sort of stuff with Haley because she just turned 11, and so I was afraid that it would overwhelm her. So instead, what she would hear was, I just don't feel good right now. You know, like I'm not well. I'm feeling sick. My thing with and. Actually, to answer your first question, I wasn't diagnosed until Haley was about 6 months old. So that was when my first diagnosis for anxiety disorder came out. And when I had my first depression disorder, it was after losing a child. And so they were like, oh, it'll pass. It's PTSD. And didn't, you know, associate it. So I didn't really think about it, and I didn't really know that was in my family. But it would not have changed the fact that I had, first of all, that I had Haley, because she's amazing. And kids, like, you absolutely, they're completely different. Like, they're born with these natural, innate, awesome things, and your job is, like, not to crush it. Like, that's your whole job is, like, make sure they still have their arms when they graduate from kindergarten, and, like, and that's it. And so they, and, you know, even if they lose an arm, whatever, they still have another one. It's okay. I know. Like, that's going to be my parenting book. No. I was actually very worried about it until Haley got a little bit older, and I realized that she has absolutely none of the issues that I have. I mean, to the point where I would like her to have more fear, to where I'm just like, "This, you're dangerous to yourself. Like, you do not know a stranger. You do not." She's so exactly the opposite of me. My sister and I were raised exactly the same way, and my sister and Haley are just could not be, they're the exact same person. And my sister, who is crazy, strong, awesome, her daughter is just like me. And she's like, how do I deal with this? I don't, like, what the, what? You have no idea. But the thing is that they all come with their own amazing things. And this is a really weirdly stereotypical sort of thing to say, but so many of the most amazing writers and artists and musicians and people who, you know, do fantastic creative things that no one else is doing, they suffer from mental illness. They may not be out front about it, but they're becoming more and more so. Pat Rothfuss, who is like one of my favorite writers, and if you haven't read him, you absolutely should. And he is brilliant and has won all sorts of awards, and he just sold his, all his books are being made into movies, and he's crazy super successful and also pretty reclusive, and is one of the people that's in my Furiously Happy video, and a lot of people don't even recognize him because he's so quiet that you would never know that this is like a major author. And his broken thing was, I feel like a failure all the time. And his Furiously Happy was, some days I can string together five perfect words. And when you look at it and you realize that sometimes you might be giving, you know, the next generation issues, you're also giving them wonderful gifts too. And the fact also that we now are so much more aware of the fact that so many of us have this, that this is not as big of a, like, oh my God, you have depression? What? You just want to go sit in this little corner with your little, like, this is, it's, we've come so far. I was doing my genealogy stuff, and we were trying to figure out, because I had just, like, all this crazy, I did, like, the DNA thing, and it came out with all this stuff, and it was, like, what was it, Jewish Iberian and Africa, and I was like, where is all this? So I'm like, okay, well, I'll do all the research, and I start looking, and I find my great-great-grandmother, her death certificate, and my grandmother was like, oh, yeah, she died of a heart attack, and she died in a mental institution from electroshock therapy and hydrotherapy, and I look at it, and this wasn't that long ago, and it was in my town, and to look, and this hospital is like still around, and now is like, oh my God, we would never do that. We know now that this was a bad idea, that this was a terrible, terrible thing. But when you look at how far we've come, and I think how much further we're going to come within the next couple of years, makes me so helpful for all of us who are either suffering or sometimes even worse, know somebody who's suffering.
Thank you.
Sure.
I feel like my question's a little less big.
I like that. That's nice.
First, my little fangirl moment. I hit a really bad depression not that long ago, and my mom handed me "Let's Pretend This Never Happened." It was the I'd read the blog, so I obviously knew about you, but I hadn't read the book yet, and it was the first time I'd laughed, and I couldn't remember how long. So I was much like yourself on the plane. I was on a train in Germany, and I'm reading this book, and I'm with my dad, and he's just looking at me. Because I'm laughing. My question is, I have to know, which cat was it that had the little tinkle ball issue? Because my mom's going to ask. She's going to ask.
So the cat that it was, his name was Bubba. And if you've read my blog long enough, you know him. But this was like years ago. So Bubba was this very beautiful Persian cat that we had, and he was like really kind of grumpy and like the worst name ever, and he had this like big old flat face, and he was like just super snobby, and he just kind of walk around like, I hate all you guys. and he had a stroke, and I took him into the vet, and the vet was like, he might be able to come back from it. It was like a stroke, like his lower body was paralyzed. So I was like, okay, well, this was after the tinkle bell thing. So he was like, we might be able to work through this, and but we're going to have to, you know, like massage his feet every day and to give him medicine and do all and hump him. And which also, if your vet ever says like, you got to hump your cat, let me tell you what that really means. It means that they're not getting enough water, so they like inject them with a big hump of water on their back, and then it like dissolves into their body, right? It does not mean what I thought it meant, which I would not have done either way, but just be prepared. But anyway, it was sort of insane, and he would go to the bathroom all over himself. So he like lived in the bathtub. So he was like Bubba the tub cat, and I shaved him because I was like always having to give him a bath every day. So we would just kind of lay there and just like look at me like, seriously, what is going on here? And Haley, who was very little at the time, would never let her pick him up, and then after he was paralyzed, she'd just pick him up, just carry him around, and he would be like, if I had use of my back claws, I would kill all you fuckers. And it was fantastic. And he actually did. He did recover for a while, but then later he had another stroke, and then he was like, just stop it now. And I was like, you got it. You got it, buddy. So, yeah. Sorry.
Awesome. Thank you.
So I discovered you about 6 or so years ago when a friend of mine said douche canoe to me. And I was like, well, that's amazing. Where did that come from? So I was Googling and trying to find the etymology, and I came across your old advice column. And then, of course, immediately began reading the archives to all my friends who were incredibly exhausted of it. But so my question is, where did you get it?
That is such a good question, and a really weird question, because that discussion has gone on a lot. Because Will Wheaton uses it every once in a while, and whenever he does, there'll be like one or two people who'll be like, you stole that from the blog us. And he's like, no, you don't steal words. And secondly, we're friends. We're allowed to use the same word. And I'm like, oh, he has full permission, and I didn't invent it anyway. And he was like, no, I think you did. You did invent it. And so I did the same thing, and I went back and I looked, and I can't find anything before, but I am sure that I did not make that up. Like, a lot of people actually have, because it ended up being this big discussion, and a lot of people have tried to find it earlier than when I used it. It's possible I was drunk and just came up with it, but it really feels like it's something that that had I come up with it, I would have been like, that's gold, douche canoe, you know? But at the same time, knock, knock, motherfucker, I didn't think anything of that either. I was just like, you know? So I guess my question is, I don't know. I mean, that's like my question-y answer. I don't know, question.
I'm just going to pretend that you said you absolutely 100% remember it next time, because...
Please do that. Say it. No, it came from my grandmother. How about that?
Yes. That actually wouldn't have surprised me a whole lot.
So, yeah, right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. Yes.
So, first of all, thank you for Beyonce, because that changed my life and many of my friends' lives. Yeah. That was my introduction to you as well, and it got passed around to everybody that I know. My question for you is, Victor, the unsung hero, the foil. I grew up in a house where everyone has cancer, cancer-related mental illness, but cancer primarily. Mm-hmm. And I know it's very hard to be a caretaker of someone with a chronic illness. So I'm kind of wondering how Victor handles all of this, including your celebrity.
Victor is both a saint and a douche canoe. Which works really well. He is a saint in that he tries to understand. Even though he doesn't understand, he still tries. He's extremely supportive. Even though I think that he doesn't really like what I do, like when I handed him the book and was like, look, read my book, and because he doesn't like to read my stuff, and I was like, look, read my book, and then he read it and he was like, yeah, that's okay. And I was like, but I'm the first person to see him on Facebook go like, my wife is awesome, you know, and so it's hidden there. But at the same time, he is really, really difficult, which is wonderful, because that's why he stays with me and that's why I stay with him. Because we both know that we fit together in a really, really good way, because he doesn't understand people and I am highly, highly empathetic. So we, like, he's the person that will just, like, walk out and say something awful not even think anything of it. And I'm the person who's, like, thinking 8 steps ahead of, like, how can I make everybody happy all the time? So we work together really well. And also he's very responsible, whereas I am the most irresponsible person ever. We very well divide up our stuff. One thing that I have not written about, and I really kind of feel like maybe I should, is the fact that I always have people who come and they're like, oh, I can't wait to meet my Victor or my Jenny. And I always think that's so lovely and fantastic, and everyone deserves that, deserves to find that person who gets you. And like, for me, Victor makes me laugh. That's the reason why we stay married. Like, all the everything else aside, he is in real life, not on paper. On paper I'm funnier, but in real life he's funnier than I am. And everybody who knows that, who knows him, would agree with that. He is really, really funny. But I do feel a little bad that sometimes I think people get the wrong idea that our life is very easy, that we're always, you know, we always get along, and it's always, you know, an easy sort of thing. And it's
people
really
who aren't
not.
Married.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, people who are married are like, oh, she left some shit out of here. For example, with Beyonce, when I wrote the whole Beyonce thing, Victor was really mad. Like, some people look at it and they're like, oh, it's funny how you've, like, made him all angry and everything. He was pissed when I brought that. And I have a rule that I never write about anybody that – I never write about any argument that we are still currently having. It can be an argument that's over, but while we're still having it – I can't write about it. That's my role. So when that happened, I waited, like, I wrote the post, and I didn't really think anything of it. I was like, oh, that's funny, and I'll save it, and I'll write it whenever he's not angry anymore. And he had to go to Hawaii for work, and he was like, well, I need you to come with me so you can help. And so I was like, oh, I'll set this up in my drafts. I'll just set it to publish. And we landed, and I was like, my blog's broken. And he's my IT. So he's like, what did you do? You fucking posted that post, and then he was mad again, and I was like, I'm really sorry. And he's like, oh, now it's going viral. What did you do? What did you do? And but now, you know, now he's like, oh, I love Beyonce. Beyonce started it all. That's fine. You just bring home the chicken, whatever. I don't care. Bring home towels. That's fine. But yeah, it's a combination of good and bad.
So, one more question.
Sure.
Did he know what he was getting into when you all met and got married?
No. No. But you know what? At the same time, I didn't know what I was getting into. I mean, I was 21. Nobody, like, who knows who you're going to be when you're 21? You're 21. You're still, like, being formed. Like, I look back at the stuff I did when I was 21, and I'm like, what was wrong with you? What were you thinking? Don't you have a mother? So in that way, no. And also, he had no clue with the whole, you know, mental illness stuff. But he knew that there was something wrong. Like, from the get-go, he was like, there's something messed up with this girl. But he still was just like, all right, let's do this. So, I don't know. Sometimes you just take a chance, and it works. And it's work, but it's really good, rewarding work if it continues to work. Which it has for 20 years. Woohoo! Two more questions. All right. Look at that hand.
Oh, now I feel lucky. So, my friend's also a huge fan of yours, and she just texted me. So I've been informed to tell you, first of all, that she thinks that you're almost as cool as Beyonce the Chicken. And also, if you have any tips for writing humor.
Oh, good question. I'm so fascinated with your hand. I'm like, let's see, tips for writing humor, right? With a disembodied hand. That's a good, let's see. I think, yeah, some people didn't see that it was a disembodied hand until, like, now. Now they're all like, oh, all right. That was, like, it took me a minute. I was like, how is that working? I got it. Okay. when it comes to writing, for me, there's a couple of things that really work. And so when I write, everything that I write, I cut half of it off immediately. So I write the thing, and then I go back and I delete 50% of it, because you always have extra crap that you like, but that nobody else needs to know. So that's always really helpful. The other thing is have readers. And I don't mean, like, blog readers. What I mean is I have, like, 4 or 5 people who I can turn to, and I can call them and say, I'm going to read you this. You tell me, is this too offensive? Is this funny? Does this work? And I'll listen to them, and I'll listen to where they laugh and where they don't laugh. And that can be a really helpful thing. The other thing is find your own voice. And I think a lot of times we have a tendency to, and I know I did it myself, where you find an author and you're like, oh, I love this author so much. I want to be just like them. And so for me, it was like Ray Bradbury and Neil Gaiman. And then I was like, I don't have a voice for that. Like, I can't write that stuff. I write it. Nobody reads it. It just goes in a box of, you know, stuff that my agent says, what? You can't do this. Go back to the funny. That's your voice. That's, you know. And she's right. The voice that you have is a voice that no one else has. So reading other people can be a wonderful, wonderful thing, but always go back to your own personal voice. And then I think the other thing when it comes to, especially when it comes to humor, and it's really, really, really hard, is especially once you get to the point where you're writing like essays and books and stuff like that, the being able to hand it over to an editor, finding somebody who you respect, who you like, who gets you. Because let me tell you, there are an awful lot of editors out there who just want to make money. And they're just like, yeah, that might make money. Okay, whatever. I'll just do a couple of things so that I can get some money out of it. Find somebody who loves your work. And you may have to work really hard to find that person. I have some friends who are my favorite writers and struggle so hard to find an editor. But when you find the right one, being able to listen is really helpful. When I handed my editor my first book, she was like, oh, this is really good, but we need to cut this, and we're going to cut this, and we're going to cut this. And I handed her my baby that I had been working on for 10 years, and she was like, oh, let's cut the arms off your baby and the legs off, and it'll be aerodynamic. And I was like, no, stop. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. And so she, first of all, listened to me, and, you know, on one or two things was like, okay, all right, well, I'll stick with you there. And then on everything else was very sure and solid, and her decisions were all right. And that's a really wonderful thing, is being able to listen to your editors. And sometimes your editors, your best editors, are like, if you have a blog and you have readers, and your readers are saying, I don't really like it when you write about this, or this came off a little harsh. So often we're tempted to say like, oh, you know, that person's a troll, or that person's a bully, or you know what? They just have an opinion. Like, I think the word troll is way overused. Like, I've had trolls before, and trolls are like, I want to rape you to death. That is a troll, and I've gotten those, you know? So that's, like, so different from, like, you're just not that funny today. You're like you're right. I will also tell you on a different subject, on the subject of trolls and all that stuff. If you do have real trolls, and for me, real trolls is just somebody who's just coming to fuck with you, basically. They're just there to say something really mean so they can come back and they can see, like, how you're going to cry. So this is how you deal with them. You go in, and if you have, like, a spam filter set up, like, I have a Kismet, so anytime somebody leaves a comment for the first time ever, I have to go in and approve it, so it goes into moderation. So if it's, you know, a troll, it's, like, somebody, like, for the first time, and they write something, you know, awful, and I will change it from, I think you should be raped to death, to, oh, my God, you're my favorite person. I wish I could be more like you. And I leave their name. I leave their everything else. And then they come right back because they want to see you cry. They didn't just leave that and walk away. They want to, like, see you, you know, upset. And then they come back and they're like, what the fuck? I didn't say that. I didn't say anything like that. I said blah. And then I change that one. And I'm like, I wish I could wear your skin. You're so pretty. Oh, my gosh. How do you get your hair like that? I have never had anyone come back after three times. Three times, they're gone. They're like, oh, no, I'm not. This is a waste of time. So I give you full permission, because, like, your blog is your house. And if somebody is going to fuck with you, you should be entertained by them. That's the way I look at it. But you can ask when you come up.
Definitely.
Okay.
Awesome. All right. What are you guys doing?
I love this. This is like the best kindergarten class ever.
Let's give another round of applause for Jenny Lawson. This is
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.